Session number 11422-1.
Well, my name is Austin. I just call myself Austin anyway, and I was born and bred in the inner city of Liverpool in 1919 in what was quaintly called the Scotland Road area. And it was a two-up and two-down house with the usual yard and small frontage, street frontage, and we were all very communally inspired people, I suppose. We were all invited to each other's houses for weddings and funerals and births, and generally we lived a very close communal life. I went to St. Bridget's School in Brevington Bush, which was a three-storey affair, infants, girls and boys in that order on each floor. And the education we received was very minimal, I suppose, but it was fairly good. And the only thing I felt rather upset about when I grew older, well, I was disappointed, was that we did have a hell of a length of our time spent on learning Catholicism. And we were brainwashed in Catholicism, which to the extent that other subjects like mathematics and general English language and one's vocabulary and the general basis of English you only received a small time of these lessons at the expense of the religious, which I thought was wrong when I left school and grew up, and then I knew damn right that, you know, that it was absolutely wrong for such subjects like that to be forgotten at the expense of religion. Not that I'm anti-religion in any way, but I'm being absolutely fair. Anyway, I left school at 14, and by that time we had moved to the outer areas of Liverpool because the family was growing up and they wanted more than two bedrooms. So we moved to an area of quaintly called Norris Green, which of course was the Kirkby of today, or the Skelmersdale of today. But nevertheless, it was to enter into a house where they had hot water, running hot water, and back garden and front garden, and where people said good morning to you, even though you were strangers, it was an absolute wonderful world to me. And I went to St. Paul's School, and the children there were, they appeared to be posh to me, the way they, because I was still had my inner-city accent. And kids use words to me like, they apologise if they misheard, or I beg your pardon and I'm sorry, and expressions like this, which were always looked upon as expressions of weakness around Scotland Road. If you apologised in Scotland Road or said I'm sorry and I beg your pardon, you were looked upon as a weakling. Oh, he's not one of the lads, that fella. That was the correct expression that was used. Anyway, I went to school, St. Paul's in West Derby, and I left there at 14. And the standard of education afforded there appeared to be slightly better than St. Bridget's. They had more time to teach you what pronouns, adjectives and verbs and consonants and general English there. And another thing I did was to get rid of my inner city accent, a lot of it anyway. I then left school at 14, and I worked for a time, as they did in those days, I worked in a butcher's shop delivering meat and pushing an order by for 7 shillings a week. And what they did, employers then, was they employed you from 14 to 16. And then when you reached the age of 16 and you wanted a little more money, well, then they fired you and they promptly ordered another boy of 14, you see. So therefore, your 14 to 16, those 2 years were wasted. And therefore, it stopped you from serving a time as an apprentice. Because as an apprentice you were taking on from 14 onwards, but you worked making tea and did all the little dirty jobs in, say, we'd say shipyard. And then when 16 you started learning your trade. But they wouldn't take you on when you were 16, they took you on when you were 14. So consequently you were denied the chance of a proper trade. So anyway, I decided to go to sea. Well, in those days, of course, there were lots of the big Atlantic liners that sailed from Liverpool and cargo boats. And well, Liverpool was one of the premier ports of the world, as you know. It was a hive of industry. And the roads used to be blacked by men at 7:30 to 8 o'clock going to work. And during the dinner hour, the whole dock area would be blacked by men going for lunch, and same at 5 o'clock, and it was a hive of industry, the whole dockside area. They had hundreds of ships, from huge Atlantic liners to tiny little cargo boats and coasters. And there was a certain amount of full employment, even though it was a northern town. Well, I mean, most industries were up north in those days before the war. But I went down to, I was told to go to see a Mr. Samuels in Bootle, who ran Lampen & Holt Line. And after three or four visits to Samuels, one day he said to me, well, now, I might need a bellboy on the ship called the Voltaire. And you'll need a uniform and white jackets and all this. And, of course, I said, oh, yes, sir, yes, sir. And the pay will be £3 a month. Would you... what do you think of that? So I said, yes. So he said, well, all right, you go home and tell your mum to get buy a uniform and get this gear. And the next vacancy that comes up, he said, you look as though you'll be all right as a bellboy. You can have the job. So I dashed home and I told mum. Now, fortunately, mum knew some of the mums who had a boy who had packed in the sea, also a bellboy, but he'd sort of swallowed the anchor, which means that he only did one trip, his first trip. And that's a term known as swallowing the anchor. And so she bought this uniform off him, the bellboy's uniform with the 18 buttons down the front, you know. And in fact, I showed you a picture of it, didn't I? And three white coats. Anyway, three or four.
Tunic.
That's right, yeah. And with the 18 buttons down the centre and three on the, each sleeve. You know, it looked very smart. And a little bellboy on each corner. What? Anyway, I won't tell you about the duties of that at the moment. But of a bellboy's duty at the moment.
Yeah,
but
tell me about the bellboy.
Yes. Well, a bellboy... each passenger's cabin had a bell push in, and at the end of each alleyway, or corridor, but on ships they're called alleyways, at the end of an alleyway was a huge bell board consisting of up to, 100 bells. And when a passenger wanted anything, it could be an aperitif before dinner, say cocktails or something like that, or they might want needle and thread, or they could want anything, but he just simply pressed the bell. And the bellboy was always standing. You weren't allowed to sit in those days. The bellboy was always standing by the bellboard, and he'd go along to the cabin, and he would ask the passenger what they wanted. And if it was something he couldn't get, well, then he'd go and tell the bedroom steward, who was responsible for that section. And he was probably cleaning the cabin, other cabins out, or something like that, you see. But that was your job, you see. And at the end of the voyage, of course, they always rewarded you handsomely. And you gained a lot of discretion and tact even as a boy, you know, and in those days. But I found that when I went to sea as a bellboy, I did become aware that my inner city Liverpool accent was slowing me down to a great extent, because I was never put into the upper class rooms. I was always put in the rooms where the not so rich people occupied, you know. Mm-hmm. And I even in those days I was a little bit intelligent, and I guessed that this was it. So I started then to sound my H's and my G's, etc., etc. And instead of saying, "What's the matter with you, lad?" you lost expressions like that. And I found that I was moved up into the higher decks and started to learn things, you know. And it was definitely a step up. And I found that I was beginning to be a bit of a snob myself in these ways, that I looked down on new boys who joined the ship and had the inner city accents, which we had to, but I taught them to get rid of it anyway. That was the job as bellboy. And then from there, you when you got to be about 18, you were getting a little bit old for a bellboy then, you see. What they did was they made you a commis waiter, which meant was a boy waiter, where you'd go down in the dining room and ship stewards who looked after tables like the captain, the chief officer, chief engineer, and the senior officers of the vessel always had millionaires, captains of industry, and men of intellect and brains and money at their tables, always good people. And the steward there was given a commis waiter to help him with they always ordered special meals, special dinners and luncheons and all like that, you know. And you began to learn first-class waiting, and of course you'd pass through the discipline of ships where you were taught how to keep your fingernails clean and shoes must be polished every morning. You learned all this as a bellboy. You used to be, incidentally, you used to be lined up outside the purser's office when you started work, and everybody had to lift their pants up 2 or 3 inches to show that their shoes had been cleaned properly and their fingernails out, and they would be inspected, you see. Well, being born and reared in Scotland Road, I thought this was, something peculiar. But then I found it was a regular thing, you know, it's that normal people did these. Same as people who didn't eat plates and plates of scouse with a soup spoon, that people were served hors d'oeuvres, and people served soup, fish, entree, joint, sweet, and everything came in its order on the menu and in its way of eating, you know. And one had an orchestra playing as one dined. And one came down in evening dress or tuxedos for dinner. And all these things were all a new world to me. And I began to listen to Mozart being played and Hungarian rhapsodies and all this sort of music to different to the music that I was born and bred to. And it was a new world. And I liked it very much so. And I realised what I'd been missing. Anyway, I was taught to be a first-class waiter, and it was in the famous Cunard White Star, a ship called the Scythia, which, by the way, went right through the war and lasted after the war. Mm. And then I was on the Samaria and the Antonia, and I was gradually made a first-class waiter. I learned that, and then what they did then in those days, before the war, you see, was you learned how to be a first-class waiter, but you were still young. You were still only perhaps 18 and a half, maybe not 19.
When you'd be a first-class waiter, you'd be as young as that, would you?
When you would finally finish from your commis waiter, you see.
Before you get... What exactly did a commis waiter do?
Well,
wait on table or just help the steward?
Oh, yes, he helped the waiter. He'd go out and bring in, and if the waiter... You see, in the case of the senior officers, what I've forgotten to tell you was, case of the senior officers, prior to dinner, they always had cocktail parties in their cabins, in which these passengers were always invited, you see. And so, therefore, some of the passengers may come down early, but the steward would be serving the rest of them up in, say, the captain's accommodation. Well, you were the captain's commie waiter, and you say, well, the captain's steward...
His Tiger.
...was called Tiger.
He would wait on the captain's table as well.
That's right. Oh, yeah, he was the captain's personal valet,
yes.
And his job was waiting on the table as well, as his valet up cleaning his room and serving cocktails and seeing his washing is done and shoes polished and all like that, and uniforms ready and all that sort. At the same time, he's responsible for his table 3 times a day down below.
Yep.
Now, The kami waiter belonging to the tiger was called the cub. C-U-B, cub, you see.
Cub.
He was the tiger's cub. Well, now, he would go down first, and he would be serving the hors d'oeuvres, and then the soup, and even the fish, whilst the tiger was still clearing up the captain's room after the cocktail party when the captain had come down with the passengers onto the table, you see. And then he would come down and join the young fellow then, serving the latter part of the fish course, and then preparatory to going on to the main joint, mm-hmm. you see. And then the tiger served the main joint, could be roast beef or chicken or tail or whatever it was, you know. And the boy, the cub, used to go after the tiger serving the vegetables. Because, you see, the cub would put the empty plates in front of the passengers, highly polished. Then the tiger would go around with the meat. We'd say roast beef. He would go around with the roast beef first. Then the boy would come round with the vegetables, which there would be three or four choice of potatoes, three or four choice of vegetables, you see. And according to the passenger's decision or choice, the commis would serve the vegetables, you see. Then after that, the savoury, the captain's tiger might serve the savoury. And then he would go...
What was the savoury?
The savoury was something like, it could be... A savoury would
this came after the main course?
Yes, it was before the sweet. To it could be, say, a little curry and rice on mixed on biscuit or something like that. Just a small dish, yeah. Not much bigger than a palm of your hand served on a plate. It could be minced chicken on toast or something like that, you see. It's sort of a tiny meal that finished off the main meal. Mm. There's a certain amount of snobbery in it, really. And yes, that's called a savoury. Served after the meal. And came the sweet.
Was that normal? I mean, all passenger ships first class would all serve a savoury, would they?
It was available if wanted, yes.
Yes.
It was one of the menus, oh yes. It was available if wanted. And if required. And a lot of passengers used to take it, but then there was even, after dinner, there was even cold meats and salad available if wanted.
After dinner?
Yeah, well, a lot of passengers wouldn't have the main course. They would settle, especially Americans, they would settle for cold meat and salad for dinner instead of
the joint
or whatever, you see. Yeah. And, of course, the English used to look down their nose at the Americans with this unusual taste.
Yeah.
And then, of course, was the sweet. And after the sweet was served, the sorbet, which was like a crushed fruit juice in ice. Then came the brandy and coffee, etc., you know. Mm. Choice of tea, coffee, or whatever you wanted. And anyway, to come back to what we were discussing about the tiger, after he had served the savoury, if anybody wanted it, but if not, he might flit upstairs back. Well, he would do then. He'd flit upstairs back into the captain's accommodation to get everything nice and tidy for the old man for when he went back up, you see. Meanwhile, you would serve the ice cream and the tea or coffee, which was fairly simple. Then that was it then. There was a meal. But
how many people would be at the table?
Usually they had six in one big round table. That would be the six would include the captain or the chief engineer or the chief officer, whatever table.
Yeah.
But the ordinary waiters, they would run eight. They would run two fours tables, you see.
And they wouldn't have a commis waiter.
No, they wouldn't have a commis waiter.
So only the senior.
Had big round
smart tables. Had the commis waiters.
That's right. Big
so
round.
Be
eight.
Three commis waiters then.
Well,
your
yes,
man,
there would
the
be three or four. The three or four, and then there might be a couple of spare commis waiters. Mm. Well, if so, if a waiter wasn't quite as good as or as fast or perhaps a new man, well then they'd give him a commis waiter until he got into the system of the ship.
I see.
Now, an ordinary waiter, he ran two fours. Two square four tables, we call them.
Yeah.
But the ship's officers always dined on a big round six or even eight table, you know.
Yeah.
But it was mostly six. And then for banquets or anything like that, they took the four tables and put them all together and made them a big, long 8 or 10 tables, you see.
Yeah.
Anyway, when you had proved that you were a good first-class waiter, you became what's eligible for full money then, which was the magnificent sum of £8.05 a month. But for that, you were now a rating, what was called a rating, which was every boy's beacon that he aimed for, you know. And that meant that you were classed as a man. It was the end of your apprenticeship, as it were.
Yeah.
But then you were sent down into the third class then.
Well, after you've been in...
Oh, yes, you were sent down because you still had not the full experience of all departments of the ship.
So you served your time in the first class.
That's correct. Then you were sent down into the third class. And you became a third class waiter, but you were on £8.05 a month then, you see. Which was a lot better than being a boy in the first class where you're only on £3 a month, you see. And you were pointed out that to be a first class waiter, you had to be, or to be a first class bedroom steward or smoke room steward, any of the men working on top in the public rooms, you had to be... in the ship for a few years, certainly in the company for 4 or 5 years at least. Not just anybody who just sort of came up the gangway was made a first class waiter, but you certainly had to be in the ship. But above all, you had to have experience of all departments. You had to have experience of serving immigrants as well as the first class, which was good when you come to analyse it, you know. So you were sent down into third class, and where you had to run 2 sittings, maybe 3 sittings at the height of summer, or the immigrant season, you know, which was the height of summer, and you would run perhaps 2 eights or 3 eights in separate sittings. Mind you, I will say this, that running the 8 third-class passengers, the menu was only soup, joint, sweet, and coffee. That was all, you see. There was no other choices. Because it was a very, very low fare going across. And the people who were your passengers were mostly immigrants. And you would leave, say, Liverpool with perhaps only perhaps a couple of hundred or even 150 of English immigrants going out to the States. But when you got to Queenstown or Cobh, as called then, you loaded up with Irish immigrants, you see. And they'd all come aboard and off you'd go to the States. You know, and they'd come aboard by tender. You wouldn't even go into port, you know. And then they would all come tramping down into the dining room. And fair play, the waiter would look at them with apprehension as they came down, because they were a crowd of... they were basically, not their fault, of course, but they were a basic crowd of basically they were a very ignorant type of farm labour and type of people who at least had the guts and courage to go out to a new land to join their relatives in the United States to get away from the poor life and poor chances of promotion that they had in their own country. And they'd come aboard, and when you proffered the menu to them, instead of... you'd been used to people taking a menu from you and inspecting it through a monocle or a pince-nez, silver-tipped and all this business. They'd take the menu from you with blackened fingernails, and they would say, "I'll have sweet, I'll have meat," which meant that they will have the meat and the sweet. They didn't want any soup, you see. "Or I'll just have soup and I'll just have the meat." "You can give the sweet to the wife." And that was it, you see, and... But they were good, kindly people, and even out of their few pounds that they had with them, they always managed to give you 5 bob for your tip going over. They were very... Oh, yeah. Or even half a crown. Yeah. And they were very, very poor people, but like most Irish people, well, like all Irish people, in my opinion, they were very kindly, generous people, you know, and they would give you that. But they always tipped you, whereas in the first class, the monocled people used to occasionally turn out to be what we call stiff, which was the waiter's nickname for people who don't tip. They were always referred to as stiffs. And, oh yes, and they were always remembered. People think that if you don't tip on a ship in those days, that was it. when you, if you made a passage coming back, there was always somebody who remembered you, and they'd say, that guy's a stiff. So you wouldn't get much service in the waiter going back. Anyway, to continue, after you'd served about 2 years or maybe 12 months as a third-class waiter, and then you were moved to the second class then. Yeah. Well, the second class was just that difference between the first class and the third class. In other words, the menu was a more varied choice, yes. And the people were more, I would say English middle class or
yes.
Trades class, you know, people yeah. of intelligence and that who were going out. Some of them immigrants and some of them were business people.
Yes.
And as I say, the menu had a little more variety, and that they used to tip you 10 shillings, you see.
Yeah.
Now, the first class was a pound.
Was it?
Yeah.
So there was a sort of a regular tariff, as it were?
For regular travellers, yeah. Now, that went on through most ships, no matter what run. If I was I'll carry on with that. But it carried on. That was most regular passengers gave you that tip. Same if you were a bedroom steward. You got a pound. Now, bedroom stewards is far better off because, excuse me, bedroom steward is far better off because he had 12 rooms, you see, 12 passengers. And therefore, he would get 12 pounds, whereas the first class waiter would only get 8 pounds. You see what I mean? Now, if he had 12 passengers, and amongst these 12 passengers, he had what we call single women. That means a lady travelling on her own. Mm. She could be married, you know, but she was classed as a single yeah. woman. Now, the stewardess looked after her, you see. Mm. But the waiter, the bedroom steward, was still responsible for cleaning the porthole and scrubbing the floor and all like that. The lady, the stewardess, simply made the bed. And adjusted the ladies' folding rolls on the, you know, room and all that sort of thing. But the lady only tipped the steward. It's the stewardess. She never tipped the steward because she never saw him. Because he used to scrub the room out when she wasn't in the room and anything like that. And she pressed the bell and the bellboy answered. Well, then she would say, could you tell the stewardess, please, bells? You're always referred to as bells. So you tell the stewardess and she would go along and do what the lady requested, the errand she wanted, or something like that. But the bells could bring the lady a drink, or something like that. But if it was beyond his ability to oblige her, well, the stewardess would get these.
So if you wanted to drink, you'd go up to the bar?
Oh, yes, you'd go to the bar.
And he'd fill a chit in, presumably, or he'd...
Well, it could do if you wanted, but a lot of passengers used to pay.
Oh, did they?
Yes, but on the Western Ocean, they mostly paid. But on the regular run like Elder Dempster's down to West Africa, where it was mostly civil servants, they used to all sign a chitty, a card. Mm. And then at the end of the voyage, they used to settle it. But anyway, to come back to the Western Ocean, the lady then would give you perhaps a tanner for going for the drink, you see, or threepence for going to the drink. Going for the drink for her, which wasn't too bad, like, you know, for me to those ladies. And even at that age, you began to be discreet. For instance, if you knocked at the cabin door and went in for something, you know, didn't need to say the bell, you might have been looking for the stewardess or something like that, and you didn't expect the lady to be in the cabin, you expected her to be on deck sunbathing or something like that. Up in the smoke room, having drinks and something like that. You always knocked on the cabin door before you opened the door, you see. And you knock on the cabin door, you're supposed to wait for, come in, and if there was no come in, well, then you naturally assumed there was nobody in. So you opened the door and walked in. Well, of course, you'd sort of knock on the door and then open the door almost the same time, you know, expecting to come in. And many times you go in, and perhaps you might catch a lady who wouldn't have much on, if you know what I mean. So you're always very discreet. You always said, sorry, sir, and you close the door behind you. Discretion, you know.
Yeah.
But by and large, they were very, very good passengers on ships, you know, because they received good service in those days.
Mm. Did they ever ask you what your first name was?
Oh, yes, yes. Quite a lot of them, quite a lot of them.
More Americans than English?
More Americans than English, yeah. They'd say, what's your name? And you'd say, Austin. Austin? God damn, that's a goddamn good name, you know. And they were kindly, even though they did wear some outlandish clothes, what appeared to you then,
yeah.
You referred to them as Yanks, but they were kindly people by and large. And they even in those days, they smoked huge cigars and were very flamboyant in their way. And to come back, you served second-class waiter. Then you went first-class waiter, then, you see.
Yeah.
And after you served first-class waiter, and you might have been in the ship then about, 5 years? Well, if a bedroom steward had retired or had been fired or he'd left the ship or something, well, then you applied for a bedroom steward's job.
Yeah.
Well, you see, you would go from the... The bedroom steward who'd left might be a first-class bedroom steward. Well, then you'd get a second or a third-class bedroom steward would be moved into the first class, and you would be sent along to the third-class bedrooms, then the second-class bedrooms, and that was the system. So by the time you come to be a first-class bedroom steward, you were pretty well experienced in every type and grade of passengers that huge ship carried. From the humble immigrant to the monocled Englishman or the cigar-smoking flamboyant American.